Welcome to Whiskey Cask, Cask Strength Conversation, featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 321 for June 19th, 2011. Coming up in a few minutes.
If you fell in there, you would actually take 3 days to drown. It's actually scientifically proven. You would take 3 days to drown. Every 4 hours, you need to get out and go to the toilet, which is if you get out here down the stairs and cross the yard.
That's Malcolm Waring, the manager at Pulteney Distillery in Wick, Scotland. Wick's almost as far north as you can go in Scotland. The end of the mainland road is 15 miles north of town, and the distilleries on the Orkney Islands are the only ones farther north than Pulteney. Malcolm will take us on a tour of the distillery later on, and I'll have the calendar of events, the emails of the week, the What I'm Tasting This Week department, and the winners of the first Whiskey Cast Father's Day giveaway. First off, let's look at the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie. Let's start off the week with a couple of new releases that you'll have to travel to track down. Kilhoman has produced what it's calling the first ever 100% Islay single malt, with barley grown and malted at the distillery, right down to the final bottling. The only thing not from Islay are the barrels, but then again, oak doesn't grow very well on the island. There are two versions of the limited edition inaugural 100% Islay release. One is bottled at 50% ABV, and it's available online through the Kilhoman website for £69 a bottle, or about $112 US. There's an even more limited cask strength version at 61.3% that comes in an American white oak presentation box. It's only available to distillery visitors at £149 a bottle, or about $241 US. Meanwhile, Stranahan's Distillery in Denver, Colorado released its latest snowflake bottling this weekend. The Solitude Snowflake started off in American white oak, then spent some time in French white oak Colorado port barrels and finished its maturation in Hungarian white oak barrels used for California Chardonnay. It went on sale at the distillery Saturday and sold out immediately. By the way, if you live outside Colorado and see a bottle of Stranahan's on the shelf, you might want to grab it. Earlier this year, Stranahan's was purchased by Proximo Spirits of New Jersey, and the new owners have restricted distribution to just inside the state of Colorado for now. The only comment came on the Stranahan's Facebook page, where the distillery expresses hope that it'll be able to resume selling outside Colorado soon. As I'm recording this episode, Proximo and the distillery have not returned my calls to get more details. I'll keep you posted as more information is available. In other news, Lagavulin's history dates all the way back to 1816. The distillery is 195 years old this year. What may be one of the oldest surviving bottles of Lagavulin has been returned to the distillery. Diageo acquired a bottle of Lagavulin liquor distilled in 1881 at auction. It was bottled 100 years ago in 1911 by the distillery's owners at the time, Mackey and Company of Glasgow. The bottle is being put on display at the distillery in what's being described as a very secure display case. Also on Islay, Beaumont has followed up on last year's release of the Beaumont 1981 with a limited edition 1982 release. It's bottled at 47.3% ABV. Beaumont's sister distillery, Auchentoshan, is also out with a new limited edition release. The Bourbon Matured 1975 Auchy is bottled at 46.9% ABV. Only 500 bottles are available. Morrison Beaumont is owned by Suntory, and while sales of Japanese whiskey fell off for a few weeks after the earthquake, tsunami, and the nuclear disaster earlier this year, demand has picked up again. In fact, Suntory says sales are so strong that it's being forced to ration export shipments of its Yamazaki single malts in Europe. JustDrinks.com quotes Suntory executive Takahiro Itoje as saying domestic sales have picked up again in Japan, while global demand remains strong. Suntory only exports about 12% of its annual whiskey production and expects the shortage to ease next year as stockpiles of aged whiskey become available. No shortage of wild turkey bourbon these days, and Campari intends to keep it that way. Campari bought wild turkey from Pernod Ricard 2 years ago and will celebrate the distillery's $50 million expansion project this Tuesday in Lawrenceburg, Kentucky. Jimmy and Eddie Russell have a really big toy to play with now. The project more than doubled Wild Turkey's production capacity from 5 million gallons a year to 11 million, while reducing energy usage, water usage, and emissions at the same time. I'll be at the opening Tuesday. More details on the next episode of WhiskeyCast. McTeers held its latest whiskey auction this past week in Glasgow. A 1964 Black Beaumont took the high bid of £2,000, or about $3,300 U.S. That's almost double the next highest bid, £1,050 for a two-bottle lot of single grains, a Celtic Heartlands bottling of 1974 Cameron Bridge, and a 1964 bottling from Dumbarton. Finally, Chivas Brothers appears to have claimed top spot in the high-priced whiskey battle for now. It's announced plans for an ultra-exclusive release of its Royal Salute blended Scotch whiskey. Tribute to Honor features whiskeys all at least 45 years old, and only 21 diamond-encrusted bottles will be available for sale by application only. The price? $200,000 each. And that's the news. It's brought to you by Glenmorangie, unnecessarily well-made. Before we get to the emails of the week, it's time to announce the winners in the first WhiskeyCast Father's Day giveaway. Many of our sponsors have supplied prize packages ranging from jackets and travel bags to golf gear, and I picked the winners at random from the lists of Twitter and Facebook followers, along with subscribers to the WhiskeyCast email newsletter. That's more than 7,000 potential winners to choose from. I've already emailed each of the winners. They'll have until this coming Friday to respond with their mailing addresses, or I'll just have to pick another winner. And here are the lucky winners. James Oliver in North Carolina wins a Glenmorangie prize pack. Jim Nemeth wins our Laphroaig prize package. Stephen Tornblom of California has won our Johnny Walker prize pack. Jens Farr of Delitzsch, Germany wins the Highland Park prize pack. Tsuyoshi Shirasu is the winner of a prize pack from Ben Romick. James Herson of Los Angeles wins a Glenrothes prize pack. Steve Murata of Saugerties, New York won an 11x14 exhibition print of one of my distillery photographs. And Annie Boyd of Scotland also wins an 11x14 exhibition print and a grab bag of goodies from the old swag box. Again, I'd like to thank you for supporting WhiskeyCast, and thanks to our sponsors for helping make this competition possible. And to all of the fathers out there, have a happy Father's Day. Now let's check the emails of the week brought to you this time around by Highland Park. Heard from Gavin Ryan Thompson in Germany this week. He posted this on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page following last week's episode. Well, Mark just finished listening to this week's WhiskeyCast episode, which I must say, short and sweet, but just right. One remark and a couple of questions, though. I liked the sound of Bal Blair Distillery out in the middle of nowhere, just my style, sitting with a weed dram in my hand, flirting with a couple of cows beside me. I like their way of thinking about vintages and not the usual age statements. To know you have quality in your hand, you can savor it more, kind of like the way of the Glenrothes. Might visit Bal Blair at some point. First question. In this week's episode 320, I was enjoying your news when all of a sudden a door slammed and a female voice was shouting in the background. What was that all about? Secondly, how can I get to meet this whiskey fairy? I think I would love to get to know her. Well, Gavin, I'm glad you enjoyed the episode, and apparently you have better hearing than I do. Or perhaps I've just learned to tune out the sound of my daughters having a quiet discussion upstairs. As for the whiskey fairy, the ones that stop at my house are all big hairy guys that drive trucks for FedEx, UPS, and DHL. Dustin Harvey caught up with WhiskeyCast after a few months away and had this question. It's been since November since I've regularly listened and noticed there wasn't a trivia question. Have these stopped or am I missing it somewhere, and when did they stop about? Well, the weekly trivia contest wound up at the end of December. It may come back at some point in the future, but we decided to give it a rest with the start of a new year. And finally, I posted the news I mentioned earlier about the $200,000 Royal Salute Tribute to Honor on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page as soon as I got the news this week. Matt Waller in Australia had one very simple and eloquent comment. It better be one hell of a good blend. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions, I'd love to hear from you. You can always use the WhiskeyCast Facebook page or just email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Highland Park.
Hello, this is Jerry Tosh of Highland Park, the makers of the best spirit in the world. If you'd like to go onto the WhiskeyCast website and click on the banner, then it'll take you to the inner circle and sign up, and we'll send you as much information about Highland Park as you'd ever need to know.
Time now for the calendar of events brought to you by Laphroaig. Tickets are still available for the Whiskey Guild's Whiskey Classic Tasting Cruise in Washington, D.C. this coming Thursday night. The Brandy Library in New York City starts its summer series of spirit schools with a class on Scotch whiskies the 24th, and will also host a launch party for Angel's Envy Bourbon on the 27th. The next Bourbon and the Girls tasting for women is July 14th at Proof on Main in Louisville, Kentucky. The Royal Mile Whiskey's annual Whiskey Fringe is August 5th through the 7th in Edinburgh, Scotland, and Whiskey Live Taipei is August 27th and 28th. You'll find a full calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Laphroaig. Become a friend of Laphroaig today and claim your own square foot of Islay. This week's WhiskeyCast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. The windswept town of Wick on Scotland's North Sea coast is home to Pulteney Distillery, where Old Pulteney single malt is made. Why the two names? Well, Pulteney was actually built as a separate town next to Wick, but over the years it was absorbed into the larger town. The distillery's founder, James Henderson, served in Parliament for a while, and like many people in politics, was just a wee bit outspoken. As a result, when he had the floor, his colleagues referred to him as Old Pulteney, after the town he represented, and that's how the whiskey got its name. Today, Malcolm Waring is the distillery manager at Pulteney and gives us a tour of the distillery.
We're on a mix of Optic, Oxbridge, and cocktail varieties, so it's okay. We're kind of averaging for the year around about 410. We're buying on a spec of 405, so I'm a wee bit ahead of the game, but some of the other maltsters, it's a bit kind of variable. It's not as good. Some are better than others. Like, maltings are like distilleries. They're all different, you know, supplying different malts. Yeah. But we're not too bad with ours. Like, you know, we're a wee bit, but it's all plain malt, less than 1 ppm, so you won't pick anything up actually in the actual malt itself. But we're not milling just now, so we should be okay when we go in. You shouldn't have too much noise there, but we'll go into the mill room.
Malcolm, tell me about the history here at Old Pulteney. How did this place get started back in 1826 or so?
Well, it was started by a man or a family called Henderson. Prior to 1826, they used to distill further inland, a place called Sibster, which is about 8 miles from where we are. The herring season, the herring boom started here in the town here, and this is where we are now, is Pulteney. And Pulteney's a kind of like an offshoot of that boom. They extended the harbour and they built this town. In the days of 1826, the road infrastructure for the county from Inverness and the market south wasn't too good, so they extended the harbour. So it enabled Henderson to get all his casks in and his whiskey out, basically, to the southern markets using the harbour. Where we are now actually is sited on a site of a quarry, so you can see, you know, the different levels that we've been on. And not also did he own the distillery, but he also owned the mill for the town, which is warehouse number 5 now. And also on the junction just south of the distillery here, he also owned a brewery. So it remained in the Henderson family up until the early 1900s. And then it had a succession of owners after that. Watson's, which became Dewar's and the Distillers Company Limited, Hiram Walker, and then Allied, and now Inver House that own us now. So it's a progression. We were closed from 1926 to 1950. Just the depression, and, you know, the industry took a downturn. So, but pretty much since 1950, we've been distilling. So we've had a couple of quiet periods in our life, but not, thankfully, not too many. But it's looking good for the future, anyway. So. In you go. It hasn't changed much since the 50s, to be honest. We're kind of still quite compact bijou, and a lot of the kit is round about the 50s. We're very traditional. You can see Porteous Peat & Malt Mill. This lady's, it's nearly 90 years old, 24-inch four-roll, and it trundles along pretty much without too much problems. You get, the mill right comes up once a year and gives it a service, and it runs away fine. You can see the malt deposits here. We've got three bins. Each one holds 50 tonnes. So we're taking around about 30 tonnes at a time up by road, each load. So we have a little over 5-tonne mash. So the transfer time from bin through the mill, through the screens, through the mill, and into the grist case is round about 2.5 hours. So it's quite a slow grind. But a traditional cast iron, stainless steel false bottom. The grist ratio is quite an open grist. We're looking for roughly about 60-65% grit, round about 30% husk, and you know, between 5-10% flour. So we've quite an open grind, quite slow. Obviously you can vary the width on how fine or how coarse you want to grind by altering the rules here. Normally if you change variety or you change supplier or you change a different type of crop, you go to your mill and just make sure that your grist composition is correct. You do a wee test on that just to make sure everything's fine. Normally if you have any problems in the distillery, distillation, fermentation, there's a good chance if you've got problems it leads back to your actual mill and your grist isn't quite right. So it's a very, very important piece of kit in the actual plant itself. But as I say, this Porteous, quite common for this age and size of distillery. Porteous were a victim of their own success. The kit that they made was absolutely fantastic. So you buy a mill once every 100 years, so Porteous are no longer in business. So it's good stuff. So the grist drops down through the mill, is elevated up in the far-off elevator, and it's conveyed along and it's dropped into the grist case in the mash house. So you can see it's a relatively new part of the actual plant itself. The most dustiest part in the distillery, to be honest. Like, it's once you're milling, the flour is so fine it gets everywhere, you know. And usually three times a week everything's stopped and it's cleaned and it's wiped down, but it's actually the most dangerous part of the actual whole milling distilling process, just so the fine flours and that, you know. It's what they call a zone part. Everything has to be kind of intrinsically safe, you know. There's no fear of any sparks or naked flame or anything like that. So
the dust is actually more flammable and explosive than the vapors in the still house, right?
Very much so. Just the fine particles in here. If something was to happen in here and you had a spark, it just straight through the whole actual everything, you know, the whole part of the plant here. So housekeeping here, you've got to keep on top of it, and you've got to keep the mill down or keep the dust down. So okay, from here then it's in through the mash house. We're a wee bit kind of compact here, but so mash tun in here. This is when we mash, we take just a little over 5 tonne of grist here, which we've deposited into this, what we call the grist case. We've taken pre-cooled water. The water's coming across here at around about 68.5 degrees. We open up the slide and the grist hits the water. So we call that the striking temperature, 68.5. So when the dry grist hits the water, temperature drops to around about 63.4, 63.5 on the spout. And then we mash that in. So we're taking 5 tonne of grist and round about 17,000 litres of water, and we've mashed it into the mash tun. That takes roughly about 20 minutes and we leave it to steep. And during that steeping process, what happens is the enzymes in the actual malt itself are converting the starch, which is held within the malt, and they're converting that into a fermentable sugar. And it's in liquid form. And we call that warts. And the warts drops down through the bed of the mash tun, through a series of interlocking plates here, a false bottom, and the liquid drops down through the pump, pumped up through a cooler and into a fermentation vessel. That's the first water, and that takes roughly a little over 2 hours. And then we drop a second water, smaller in volume but hotter. This time it's around about 72 degrees, Same idea. You leave it to steep, and then you extract that wort as well through the same cooler and into the same fermenter. And then you have a third and then a fourth water, one at 85 and one at 87 degrees, both round about 9,000 litres. And that's sprayed onto the bed here in that sparge ring there. And that goes back to a hot liquor tank, which is used then for the first water of the next mash. So it's basically just a rinse. And then you empty out the draft there and the whole process starts again. So a mashing cycle here at Poulton is round about 6 hours, 45 minutes.
This is just a pine outer shell, right?
Just a plain outer shell, that's right, Mark. It's just something we put on ourselves. But it's actually, you can see it inside there, it's a cast iron shell, stainless steel canopy and a stainless steel false bottom. Mash tun's round about early 70s, 1973, I believe. So it's quite a deep bed mash tun. You can see there the loading on it. Once we mash in, you can see the ring at the top there. So we're roughly about a foot from this level here once it's filled up. So what you're seeing now, that's the third water just applied. So the mashman now, he's giving it a stir up just to make sure everything's kind of filtered down through it. He'll stop the rake there, which is semi-louter. It'll revolve forward or backwards. So full outer rake gear you can lift up as well as revolve it. So he'll stir that for about 5 minutes and then stop that and then start pulling off the third water. And what's left, the residue left in there is draft. We call it draft, and it's just the husk that's left. We sell it on market here in the county as wet draft. So it goes for local cattle. They feed on that. So never leaves the county, actually. Some places they'll dry that. They'll mix it up with the pot ale, which is the residue from the first distillation, and they'll dry it. And I'm sure you've seen it, these little wee pellets. Call it cattle cake, and that's or distiller's dark grains. And that's all it is draft and pot ale mixed together and dried.
How did you wind up here?
Oh, gee whiz, 22 years ago. A man called John Black, who John's actually manager now at Tullibardine, very, very nice gentleman. He took me on into the industry. Still waiting for my interview, actually, but never actually got one yet. But John does keep promising me every time I'm in to see him that I'll have to get you that interview, Malcolm, to see when you can start. So 22 years on, I'm still here anyway.
But you worked your way up through the entire process, right?
I did, yes. When I first started here, it was all through the shifts, mashman, stillman, warehouseman, head warehouseman, and then left here as assistant manager. Spent a wee bit of time on Speyside, 6 years, and then came back about 5 years ago as manager. So,
you grew up around here?
I grew up here. I'm not actually from these parts, but I grew up. I was a very small boy when I moved to Wick. So, my wife's from up here. My family were all born here. So, class Wick is home, actually. So, it's fine. But I've a mixture of mercies, me. So.
What makes Wick a unique place to live, besides being so far north and pretty much as far north as you can get in Scotland without going off the main part of the island?
Well, you've really said it, Mark. We're so far north. You know, there hasn't really been an influence of anything over generations. It's just, you know, it's local people that's grown up and it's changed the place. You know, it's grown the place. It's honed the place. I mean, all these boys that work here, they're all local guys. You know, and they're a different kind of people the further north you get from what you have further south. You know, no, I'm not saying that in a bad way to people south, but because you've been isolated for so long, you become more kind of self-sufficient, more independent, and you have a different kind of mindset on how you do things and how you apply things. And I think it comes out in, like, you know, in the actual process itself, and, you know, what we produce is a culmination or a distillation of that. Right, we'll go on now. We'll go on then. We're up to the tun room now.
Smells great in here.
It does, guys. Different parts of the plant, you get different smells, you get different temperatures. Just got the heat and the malty smell from the mash tun, and now we're going up the tun room there. So you'll get the CO2, you'll get the spirit, you'll get the yeasty smell now. Thank you.
We're at the fermenters now, and I think this is part of what you were talking about, the way you guys do things uniquely here. A lot of other distilleries, really nice, really showy fermenters with the pine on the outside. And here, very utilitarian, very, very simple cast iron and plywood covers for the door on the top that you can just pull off instead of a nice big hinge and all that just to get in.
That's right, Mark. These are actually Corten steel. They're mild steel outside and a stainless steel liner. They're actually from 1920, these were fitted, so they've, you know, 90 years old, they've seen a lot of whiskey. So you can see this one here, this is number one. We've actually got six here, we've got five here in the tun room, and number six is through in the still house. But in here we've got 23,500 litres of worts. We've added 28 kilograms of yeast. Now we use dried yeast here, which is quite different in the industry. I think out of, 93 working distilleries, there's only about four or five of us actually using dried yeast at the moment. So we've added 28 kilograms of that, and we give this a minimum of 52 hours fermentation. Some get slightly longer, but it's around about 52 hours. So roughly after fermentation, it's around about 8% by volume. So if you fill in there, you would actually take 3 days to drown. It's actually scientifically proven. You would take 3 days to drown. Every 4 hours, you need to get out and go to the toilet, which is, if you get out here down the stairs and cross the yard. So this is called wash. So it's, you can see here, these are actually what they call switchers. We don't need to do that here at Pulteney. These, I think, in 22 years I've been here, I've never actually seen a washback switch yet.
And for those who aren't aware of it, what does a switcher do? It basically takes the foam off the top, right?
That's right. After when you fill the washback, it goes through a lag phase. It gets very, very quiet, and the yeast starts to adjust itself, and then it starts going for the sugar to reproduce itself, and it's an energy source. And when it does that, it's giving off a few byproducts. One, it's making spirit. It's releasing CO2. It's increasing the temperature, and it produces this head. And if you leave that head unchecked, it'll go up the head of the washback. And go over and drop down, and it'll add like a vortex effect, and it'll just empty itself out. So to check that and to stop it, you put these switches on, and that revolves around quite fast, and it keeps the head down. If you get a really good violent fermentation on a wooden washback, you see the whole lot just going like that, and they lift the lid off and it's spraying everywhere, you know. It's quite something else. Because we've got quite a deep bed mash tun. What causes that is the lipids, it's the fatty acids that's producing that head. We have a deep bed mash tun, so it's quite compact, quite deep. What that does, it produces a very, very bright, clear wort, and it strips out some of the lipids. So when you fill it in the washback, you don't get that same foam.
Now, you've had these washbacks for 90 years. What's the useful life on this? Can they go another 90, or realistically just with new steel?
No, these probably another 2 or 3 years, and that'll be them. They'll be going out. You can see some of them, the actual bears across the top, they're starting to part company there. It's a great shame, to be honest, but it's going to have to come to a time that we're going to have to change them. So it'll probably be in the next year, well, a couple of years.
That's going to be a big project, isn't it?
Yep, that's take the roof off, strip everything out, lift them out, and lift the new ones in. So because of the way you're geared up for production throughout the year, you've got a window in the summertime, so you're silent normally for about 4 or 5 weeks. So you try to shoehorn everything in a 4 or 5 week period. So these will actually be made off site. So when the time comes when we switch off, we go silent, everything will be off, lifted out, and then back in.
Now it's interesting because when you replace these, will you try to duplicate them as best you can, or will you use wood at that point? Will you continue to use steel?
Continue to use steel. Although there won't be Corten steel anymore, there'll actually be stainless steel. But they're stainless steel liners, so the environment that they are now won't change. Won't change. But we'll have they'll all be domed top with windows and nice doors on it, so they'll look the parts. You put an extra washback, you can actually increase capacity of the distillation process. So hopefully when I go to replace this, I'll try and get another washback in somewhere along the line and get 7 in here. So you can see just here over here, gents, this is our yeast here. As I mentioned, we're one of the few distilleries in the industry just now who are using dried yeast.
If you stick your nose in that and have a smell of that, you'll find a nice strawberry smell.
Yeah, it is a very berry-like flavor in there.
Very much so.
What gives it the flavor?
Just
or the aroma?
It's the process where that's made. This is it's like a distillery, you know. It's different yeast plants produce a different. It's the same strain, but you'll get that in the process. It puts this nice kind of strawberry bouquet to it. Very nice.
Does this give a different result than you would use if you used another types of yeast?
No. What we found was because we're so far north and a wee bit out the way, we're kind of problems if the winter time when the road gets really bad, the weather gets bad, they close the roads. If you're using a pressed yeast as we used to, or a liquid yeast, you need a delivery maybe certainly once, maybe twice a week. If they close the road here, basically we couldn't get any yeast in. So we spent probably best part of a year experimenting with dried yeast. Dried yeast, the shelf life is a long, long time. It'll probably keep for about 5 years or probably more. Because it's small bags, you can get a lot in, so your delivery is maybe once, twice a year. The secret with dried yeast is the rehydration temperature. If you can get it rehydrated at 36 degrees, it works good. We experimented a long, long time and different things to try and get that, and we finally cracked it and we get it to work. It never actually changed our new make spirit. That was one of the key things when we were experimenting with it, that the new make wouldn't change, and it didn't. But what it did do, it highlighted our new make spirit, it highlighted all the esters and all the fruits, and it brought that out more using the dry yeast as it was, as opposed to using Quest or butter yeast or paste.
So it did change the whiskey to a certain extent.
Just highlighted certain aspects of it. I wouldn't say changed it, highlighted more. It's something that was always been there, but it brought it on and highlighted it a wee bit more. What I've noticed with the dried yeast as well, the actual lag phase isn't as long. Normally what we found here when we were using pressed yeast, your lag phase would be about 8, 10, 12 hours. After 4 hours of filling the wash back, that's working, it's kicking in. But the only thing you do have to do, you've got to give it a bit longer. Normally used to pump the washbacks at 50 hours, but what we found is it needs that extra couple of hours. So it's starting off quicker, but it needs a longer time fermentation. So usually now we're giving it 52 hours, and you do get the benefit of that. But the genuine maritime malt has to use anchor yeast. We searched all over the world for that. So, this is the mashing process. One guy looks after that from the receipt of malt in, milling, mashing, and filling the washbacks. After 52 hours in, it's pumped down to the still house, and that's where we're going to go next.
How many guys do you have working here?
We've actually 8 on shift, myself and 2 girls in the visitor centre. So there's 11 of us, probably in its day when the maltings was on site and we had warehousing squad, there would probably been around about 35, 40 people in its day. But we're down to 11.
Now back in the day, fishing was the big industry in Wick. Is it fair to say that this is probably the biggest industry or the biggest single business in Wick now?
Probably not far away, actually. I would say the biggest one in Wick is retail, some of these supermarkets. But the last of the old traditions, I would say, we are probably in the town. Fishing is no longer, it's herring seasons. Well, the herring fishing is pretty well done now. It's all done commercially, bigger boats. Mainly in Wick now, it's a lot of shellfish caught. A lot of crab, a lot of lobster, langoustines, things like that. So it's smaller scale. And it's mainly hand lines that they catch herring with now. They go out and fish during the day and come back in, and it's done very, very small scale.
But this is the only product in Wick that actually goes out to the world, right?
Oh yeah, very much so, yeah, very much. Can't think, there's nothing else in the town here. Nothing else.
We're in the still house now, and the shape of these pot stills is extremely unique. It's what is reflected actually in the old Pulteney bottles now, right, Malcolm?
That's correct, Di. This wash still here is the bottle of Pulteney that we use as a copy of the actual wash still here. Some of you guys, I think, maybe you've only been to a couple of distilleries before, but it doesn't matter if you do them all, you ain't going to see nothing like these anywhere else in the industry. They are
totally different, totally unique, completely different from more or less anywhere you'll go, really.
And the ball in the middle, what does it do in terms of affecting your spirit?
Because they're quite small, squat stills here, to increase reflux, you've got this huge, big boil ball here. So that's increasing reflux, and what it's doing is producing a big, heavy, squat, oily, beefy, veggie new mix spirit. And that's what it's giving off here. So you can see the flat top here. There's no swan neck on the top of the wash still here. Live pipe stuck on the side here and coupled up to the worm, which is just outside here. Same with the spirit still here. You've got an inverted U-bend coming out here, which is going into the purifier. Although we don't use a purifier, we've never used a purifier for many, many years, it's still actually in the process. So to enable the vapors to get in through there, you've got a downward inverted U-bend there and out to the worm then as well. Quite big stills. Charge of the wash, you're roughly about 17,500 litres wash still. And the charge of the spirit still is 13,500 litres. So our run of the wash still is around about 5 hours, and our run of the spirit still, we're running about 7 hours. So over 12 days, they're more or less running continuous. You have a small downtime in between fermentation times to catch up, but they're running more or less flat out all the time. So basically what you're doing is you're using your spent run to heat up your new charge that's coming in. Close everything up, open up the steam valves, and start your distillation process then.
Was the shape of the stills dictated by the height of the still house? Because you have maybe 10 feet clearance at the top of the roof over the wash still and about 3 feet over the top of the spirit still.
When the still was built in 1826, we actually had 6 pots. Right, I think it was the 1920s, they wanted to increase the actual capacity of the distillery. And the easiest way to do that, other than physically grow the distillery, which we didn't have the space for at the time, was to take out the 6 pots and replace them with 2 identical ones, but much, much bigger. You can see here where the actual height of the original building was. So the story goes, they did all the calculations, they did all the changes, the new stills arrived, the old ones came out, the new ones went in. Because they were much higher and bigger than the old ones, they couldn't get the roof back on. So they had to put the lye pipe on the side. And just with the advent of years going on and changes, the actual height of the distillery then has gone up the way. But because we've been distilling like this for many, many years, it's remained the same.
How does the climate here affect the whiskey and affect the maturation?
Well, we get about 5 days of sunshine a year, to be honest. Like, the rest of the time is very, very windy and wet, and the water is very cold. Hempriggs Loch, you're guaranteed to get lots and lots of cold water, around about 8 degrees, so we never have a problem with that.
Yeah, tell me about the water supply.
Loch Hempriggs, it's roughly about 3.5 miles south of Wick. When you're leaving, heading down the road there, if you look to your right, you'll see the loch there. It sits on what they call the edge of the flow country, which is a big, huge, moving peat bog. It's an overspill from a few other lochs, so some tributaries from other lochs fill up Hempriggs. The water carried from Hempriggs down to Wick follows what we call a lade. It's man-made, it's designed and built by Thomas Tilford, who back in the early 1700s was a civil engineer, and he was a man ahead of his times. So it's 3.5 mile long lade. There's a 12.5 foot drop between the loch and the actual distillery itself. When they built Pulteney as the new town because of the herring boom, the actual water originally was to be designed to supply the town, the mains water for the new town. It also drove the mill, and it was water for the brewery and then the distillery as well. Lots of water, nice, clean, clear, soft water. Never have a problem in here having to treat it because it's soft water anyway. It's good water.
And it doesn't run out?
Never seen it running out. The only time you might have a problem if you get a lot of snow, and then because it's open, it's an open lade, some of the fans of snow might go into the lade and it'll stop the water. So you've actually got to go up there and dig it out. But there's always water. Sometimes it's just maybe it's blocked because of the snow. But normally it's not a problem. Not a problem.
Always water. Sometimes some of it's solid.
Some of it's solid and white, yeah. But no, I never had a problem with water.
See the lock on the spirit still? Everything up to this point here has been open. Normally, after every run of the wash still, the door's opened up. But now, we've got a lock here in the spirit still. Her Majesty's Customs and Excise start taking a great interest in what we do from this point on. So, it probably only opened about three times a year, usually just on a silent season. It's cleaned internally. We have a CIP system in it, so one of the guys nowadays thankfully have to go in and clean it. Now it's all done with a CIP system. So,
but back in the day, you used to have to get inside and clean them, right?
Very much so. Yeah, jump in it. It was hot, so you used to jump in with a bag of steel, a bucket of caustic, and a handful of steel wool, and clean everything. And it was normally about 5 o'clock in the morning. In those days, we were working 7 days a week, so you got every fourth weekend off. So the fourth weekend was spent with a lot of quality control. So you used to come in and start your early shift on a Monday morning at 5:30, and the first job you had, jump into the wash still and clean it with a bucket of caustic. And by 6:30, 6:45, you didn't have a hangover anymore. You felt just fine then.
Now, was this the kind of job that would have been rewarded with a dram?
Yeah, any job in the distillery at the time was rewarded with a dram. Three times a day, everybody used to stand at the cooperage door. The door we came out of, the brewer used to sit there. It had a big copper flagon there, and he had a what they call a dooker. And if you stood in line, you got your dram three times a day, morning, noon, and night. You didn't have to actually just be a worker here. If you were in for any reason, if you were a contractor and you were in working, you stood in the queue, you got your dram. Now, it wasn't a social gathering. It was in an orderly queue. The man in front had his dram. You didn't linger with it. You didn't stand there. It was down the hatch in one go, or else you got a tap on the shoulder, come out, hurry up. And usually at Christmas time, the brewer went into the warehouse and you got mature whiskey. But normally it was as it came off the still. You're talking white, you know, new mix spirit, around about 68%. There was a wee cupboard on the wall here in the still house, and there was two bottles in that. And that was for the night shift. So when these started to come in, there was two bottles of spirit there for them. They could either drink it on shift, or they could fill up their own wee bottle there and take it home and take it when they got home. That probably only stopped about 25 years ago. Responsible drinking nowadays, they went from that and they were given a product once a month. So you went from three times a day getting a dram to like getting a bottle a month. It was like cutting off these right hands for some of these older guys, you know. So it was pretty hard to take. But that was common. That was common, like, and not too many years ago either.
And we can blame Her Majesty for that too, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Now, most distilleries, the spirit safe is in the same room with the stills, but here the spirit safe is a couple of rooms over, right?
That's right, it's in the receiver room. Many years ago, the actual safe used to still sit just below the still. In the corner here was the water wheel, so when everything was belt driven, the safe was through here, but with the change of rounds in the 50s, the spirit safe came through here. You can see it, quite a nice dinky wee safe here, just two pots, so you don't need anything big. What you've got flowing in here is low wines from the wash still. We collect that into this receiver, around about 25% by volume. The two bowls here, the one on the left is for four shots and tailings, again collected in this receiver. And when we run on spirit, as we are now, into this bowl and into the intermediate spirit receiver. Every run of the spirit still, we're collecting spirit around about 60, 68% by volume. So it'll come in at about 74% by volume. We'll run that down to about 63, so collectively it's around about 68. So we've got roughly about 2,200 bulk litres at 68% each run. So it goes into the ISR here, and from here then it's pumped across to the filling store. So we're either filling into cask for customers, into tankers for customers, or into cask for ourselves, and it's warehoused on site. So you have low wines, four shots and tailings. Collectively they're called feints, and that's what makes up the charge of the spirit still. So that's anywhere between 25 and 30% by volume.
Now, you mentioned that you fill tankers up for customers. That all goes for blending stock, right?
They all blend with that, yeah. We fill for different people. Roughly around about 40% of our production this year we sell onto other companies, and they'll take it away, they'll fill it into the cask and put it into their own warehouses and blend with it. Everything that we retain for the company is filled into cask here on site and matured on site for single malt.
What does Old Pulteney add to a blend?
Oh, you get the nice, it puts body into it. It lends a bit of fruit. It lends a bit of brininess to it. So it's quite a, quite an important constituent in a lot of blends actually out there. You get some of the, you know, the big people in the industry like Chivas, White Mackay. They all, you know, buy from us and use Pulteney in their blends. So it's quite a quite an impact on a blend.
Where does the brininess come from if you're not aging it up here to get the sea air?
In the just in the environment, what you've got here, I mean, you're going to get a, you know, a windswiptness to it, like, you know, just regardless where it is. So you've got a, it lends this kind of character to it.
So it's picking it up through the water, through the basically through the air as it's going through the entire process. Then instead of coming in through the casks that it, as it ages up here.
Exactly. More pronounced here when it's on site here, actually, in the 12-year-old. Probably more in the 12-year-old than it is in an older age, but you certainly pick it up more then.
What do you guys think about here at the distillery, or when you travel, because I know you travel around the world occasionally, but when you guys are here at the distillery and you see casks going out to be bottled, and you realize that that whiskey is going out literally all over the world, and you had a hand in making it, or when you're, say, at an airport and you see a bottle of Pulteney at the airport, or you're at a festival and see people drinking the whiskey that you guys have been making here for so many years, what does that make you think?
Oh, it's hard to describe. You know, it's something, you know, when you see that, you know, you see how it goes worldwide. I mean, you know, we're standing in the stillhouse here at Pulteney, you know, the middle of nowhere, absolutely, you know, nowhere city, you know, in the middle of the wilderness, and you see folk doing that. It just, I mean, it's really hard to describe, you know. Makes you so proud, you know. It's a cliche, but it really does, you know. It just fills you up, you know. If somebody, you know, you can sit here, middle of nowhere, do what you do, you enjoy what you're doing, and then it you know, it gives so much pleasure to everybody else really throughout the world. It's absolutely fantastic, absolutely fantastic, really good.
How many visitors do you get through here?
Somewhere, maybe, you know, because we're off the beaten track, it's around about 4,000-5,000, which is not a terribly big number. Because we're out the way a wee bit, you know, people that do visit us, they know they're here because we exist. They know we're here, so they deliberately come to look us out. So we don't get a lot of passing tourists. It's people who specifically come to visit Pulteney. Okay, so we'll go across to the filling store. This is Donnie Forrest. He's probably one of the old timers. He's been. He's probably hauled how many millions of gallons of whiskey through?
Millions and millions. Yeah.
Never spilled a drop.
Never spilled. Well, I've spilled one or two. Mostly when I'm drinking it. Or once I've had a few.
On a Friday or Saturday.
On a Friday or Saturday, yeah. Yeah, it's a fine place this to come.
It's good.
Now, I got to ask you, Donnie. That's a pretty narrow passage to get this big rig into. Yeah. How hard is it to actually pull your lorry into here to pick up and drop off?
Well, if you listen to the guys that work here, they keep you right. You know, they tell you where to position it to reverse in. And then coming out's worse with the load on. You've got to keep right over tight all the way around, you know, and sort of jackknife it out. But you've only got about that much space.
And you're holding your fingers together about 3 inches apart.
Yeah, that's right.
We're designed for horses and carts when it was built in 1826. And there's guys like Donnie that come in here with 45-ton Arctics here, and they're getting in here and turning them on a pencil. So it's a lot of skill to get in and out, to be honest.
You ever think about reconfiguring things to make it a little easier for Donnie?
Not much we can do. We've done what we can, to be honest. But there's a few drivers that have come in to try to reconfigure it without our permission, but sadly...
No.
You've never tried the reconfiguration trick yourself?
Not myself, not personally, no. I know people that have, but...
Well, what's the worst damage you had from somebody trying to get through here?
We've had this wall come down. We've actually had a rig that's been jackknifed. His trailer was right up here. His unit was up that way. The only way we were going to get him kind of sorted out was that we had a crane, big huge crane come in, and basically they just lifted him up and turned him and dropped him down. So this wall's been up and down a couple of times. Some of the wall here... we've ended up deliberately had to take about 8 feet off the wall. Some of them have done it manually, but...
And we should point out, if you look at it, I mean, it's hard to explain this for audio, but you can tell where the wall's been repaired because the old walls are black with a little bit of mold and with wear and tear over the time. The bricks on that wall that have been replaced are sort of a nice golden tan, right?
That's right. That's right. They've been up and down more times than I don't know what, to be honest.
There's not a lot you can do, is there? Because it'll be a listed building, you know. The planning, I thought, you can't just put any type of brick in
it.
No,
you've got to keep it within the realms of how it was built.
Yeah.
Now, you're hauling tankers to Spirit out, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Where will you take it to?
This goes down to Airdrie. Is it near Glasgow? Just outside Glasgow.
Mm-hmm. And that's where the main Inverhouse blending and bottling plant is, right?
That's right. That's correct. That's our main office. Okay. Sorry?
See you later. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. Haven't gained a pound, have you?
That must have been diet fish and chips I had last night. Low-fat fish and chips I had last night. You see how the scales are wrong?
That's measuring in kilos, right?
Yeah, and you see now how the scales are right as he steps off. Yeah, it measures. Years ago, when you fill casks, what you did, we worked what they call the old gross and tear method, where the cask was, although it's still stenciled, a full end plate stencil, you used to actually weigh the casks empty. You would take a charge in this Spirit Receiver Warehouse Factory, the SRWV, so you knew how many litres of alcohol you had. So you'd weigh the cask empty, you'd fill it up, and then you would weigh it full. So you could work out individually how many litres of alcohol was in each individual cask. They do vary slightly, by about 4 or 5 litres, but there's an accepted method now that we can do for filling, and it's called average fill, and the customs allow us to do it. So basically, whatever you remove from the vats and you filled into cask, it's spread equally amongst each cask, and it speeds the process up. So what we're doing here is we're putting in, he's going to take 32,000 litres of spirit out of here in just a little over 2 hours. If you were to fill into cask 32,000 litres, it's the best part of 2 days' work. So any system you can get that can speed up a cask filling is very welcome. So now we use an average fill, so you can speed up your fillings now, and you can get it into cask and into warehouse a lot quicker now than what we could. So what we have here lying about, these were filled yesterday. So these are refill American bourbon casks. So once this tanker's gone out, this is going to go off to the warehouse then. So the boys will put these to the warehouse. So it's usually every 4 or 5 days we have a customer tanker that goes away, and then the rest of the time we fill into cask, and we spread the fillings out throughout the year. Fill a variety and sizes of casks. We've first and second fill American bourbon. We've got hogsheads, dump, traditional, butts, puncheons. We fill it all for the different expressions that we have.
If you could, Malcolm, please describe the filling apparatus here, because basically it looks like a fire hose with a nozzle on the end with a tapered nozzle that fits right into the bung, right?
That's pretty well what it is. We've got one outlet here from goes down into this, what they call a head here, and you've got two isolation valves which are always locked unless you're filling, and it goes into this hose here. You can use what they call a cocaine system, where it's done automatically, and there's a head on here that measures how much goes into each cask. We don't. We've got a manual valve, so the guys are standing there. They drop down this head here into the actual bunghole in the cask itself, turn it on, fill it up, switch it off then, bung it, and then go and get your new one then. So it's quite it's traditional. It's traditional way of doing things.
I know I've seen other distilleries where they actually use a gasoline pump type nozzle to do that with the handle and everything, and it just looks like you're filling up a gas tank.
That's pretty much the same, mine. You just got to rely on it that it actually works and it'll shut off. There's been some what they call a gusher. So if it doesn't actually hit off and then trigger it and switch it off, it poof, comes right over. But everything's quite manually, quite traditionally done. What we're using here now, we've got, these are poplar, these are softwood bungs. By the very nature of making what you want to call single malt Scotch whiskey, you have to have it in an oak cask. Biggest cask you can use, incidentally, is 700 litres, no more than that. Traditionally what they used to use was, the bungs was actually hardwood, they were actually oak bungs. Very tight, not particularly good as a bung. They went then on to cork bungs, softwood bungs, but what that did was it increased your loss, actually. You had bigger losses using cork. So what we now go to now is an American poplar white wood, soft bung, but very, very good. Very good. You still can get traditional hardwood bungs, but mainly in the industry now, it's all softwood poplar.
And the good thing about the softwood is that it sort of expands out once it's hammered in so that you don't get any leaks, right?
That's correct, Di. It'll expand out. If the spur gets to it, then it'll expand out and swell and seal it up.
You'd never use a plastic bung, would you?
Never, never. Not in the days of man, no. See here, we still use a traditional end plate. Some places now you'll go to, you'll get maybe a barcode on it. Some of the grain distilleries more so when you've got a very high volume of fillings, they'll use a barcode, but we like to see a proper end plate. You've got Pulteney Distillery, you've got the year, you've got the individual cask number. We used to colour code it by painting the ends. If it was plain or white, it always was a first fill. Yellow was a second fill, blue was a third fill, and so on. But now what we do is I like either white or black. So it'll be a white end with a black stencil or a black end with a white stencil. But what we use now is we use these coloured discs with just hammer on, and that denotes the actual style of cask, whether it's first fill, second fill, if it's dechar, rechar, or sherry. So when these go to the warehouse, they'll have a disc stamped on it. So when they're dumped, we know exactly what the cask has been prior to that. So it's like keeping an inventory. We have keep an eye on the casks on what styles they are. We know what we've got.
Ratio, first fill, second fill, sherry, and stuff like that?
Well, it's pretty mixed, to be honest. What we do have, roughly, I would say about 95% probably is American oak, around about 5% European. But predominantly, it's for the 12-year-old, it's mainly first fill, 17, 21, 30, it's refill. It's refill.
What do the different casks add to the spirit, to the flavor over time between the European and the American oak?
You've got a lot slower maturation there with European. So, you know, 21-year-old, 17-year-old tends to go into what we call big wood, European oak, slower maturation. Smaller the cask, more surface contact with the wood, you get a faster maturation. So with the 12-year-old, it's mainly, most of its casks that come together for the 12-year-old is all first fill American bourbon. Having a big, heavy, beefy kind of new make spirit, you put that into a good quality air-dried American cask, you get nice butterscotch, you get nice coconut, and that's what comes out in the 12-year-old from the casks themselves.
So now with the Old Pulteney 21-year-old, that's pretty much some of the stock that you were just starting out making when you got here first, right?
Pretty much so, aye. I was the stillman that night the 21-year-old was made, as they say, but it pretty much is, yeah. Can't lay claim to the 30-year-old yet, but advent of time, hopefully I can then, so. So from here then, it's off to the warehouse. If I go and grab the guys, get the warehouse key, we can go in and have a look at warehouse number 6.
Still have the double locks on the doors?
Still have the double locks. Some traditions you can't break. Here we are, warehouse number 6. It used to be the malt floors, now it's bonded warehouse. Probably the biggest one physically that we have. You can see it's dunnage, 3 high hoggies, 3 high barrels, 2 high butts. All up by hand. 5 warehouses here. We've got 2 steel racked and 3 dunnage. The biggest one, actually, capacity-wise, is racked.
Now, this is probably one of the brightest warehouses I've seen. You've got natural light coming in through the clear panels in the roof that make it a lot easier to see in here than in other distilleries.
That's right. All the single cask bottlings that we've had has actually come out of this warehouse. It's a different warehouse. It is quite low. Geographically, it's quite low, but as you can see, it's quite airy. It's quite bright.
But it's also a little higher up above the distillery proper, too. So in terms of the ground level, so you're actually getting some more sea air coming up here, right?
That's right, Di. A bit more windswept then. It's taking in a bit more of the environment.
Now, I see a pallet over here with about 50 or 60 bags of charcoal. You guys planning a cookout or what?
That's actually exactly what it is. That's barbecue charcoal, yes. We've managed to get, we're very, very thrifty up here. And this is the boys and my wee stash of barbecue fuel that we managed to procure quite cheaply from somebody locally. So we can outdo the supermarkets. So it's our wee store of barbecue fuel. In the 5 days of summer that we get, we do go through a bag of charcoal. But that's just exactly what it is.
Now, I guess sort of the traditional question you ask every distiller when you go into their warehouses, what's the oldest cask you guys have on site here?
The oldest one we have on site is actually a 1967. It's a hogshead, what we call a dumps hogshead. It started off life as an American bourbon barrel, and it's been extended out. So a few extra staves put in it and a few extra end staves put in it. So it's bulked out from 200 litres out to about 250, around about. And it's sitting down in warehouse number 5 at the moment. But that's the oldest one we have on site. Maybe it's not the oldest one kicking about in the industry, but certainly at Pulteney 67. We've some 67, 68s, and then just a lead on different years, a few gaps, but you know we have quite a selection to choose from.
How will you and Stuart Harvey, the master blender for Inverhouse, decide what gets released as a single cask bottling?
We're looking for something slightly different. You've still got the style of Pulteney, but you want something a wee bit kind of quirky, something a wee bit different, you know, different away from the normal style. So once it gets to a certain age, we're sampling these casks just to see with an idea, you know, with one parsley that probably lends itself more to the style of the 12 or the 17 or the 21, and then you come across something different and you say, yep, bang, that's a single cask bottling. That's something unique, something different. Hard to describe really, because it's not something you're actually looking for in particular. What you're looking for is something that's different.
And you'll know it when you find it?
Straight away. You'll know exactly straight away when you find it.
Of the various Pulteney expressions, which one's your personal favorite?
Oh,
yeah. I know it's like asking which one is your favorite kid, but...
Okay, I'll tell you how it goes. If I have a group of friends around and there's a few people, we drink normally the 12 years old. If my father-in-law comes round, he's like my wife, he has expensive tastes, and we drink 21-year-old. But normally, I'm sitting in the house at home on my own, I'll probably reach for a bottle of 17. That's how it goes.
Right in the middle?
Right in the middle, yeah. Right in the middle. Just the style of it kind of suits my palate. That's what I like about it. But, I mean, it's horses for courses, as they say. It's, you know, there's a whiskey for everybody and, you know, how everybody's palate is and is different. So.
Can you see yourself ever working in another distillery?
I have done in the past. Spent 6 years looking after Knockdoo Distillery. When I was assistant manager, I used to cover different sites, different distilleries, sickness, holidays, that kind of things. But
this is home.
This is home. I don't look at this as a job. This to me is a way of life. And you know, guys and who you know the same as myself. You know, it's not a job. It's a way of life. And you know, it's like if you go to a different distillery, it's like changing a lifestyle. You know, and it's. Sometimes it's difficult to do, and you get used to what you're doing, and you know you love what you do, and it's hard to visualize yourself doing something else.
Can you see yourself staying here till retirement?
Oh, well, I hope so. Yeah, I'd like to think that. Hopefully, God willing, I'd like to.
Let's project out 40, 50 years into the future. What do you want your legacy to be? Because when they talk about distilleries that have been around since 1826, you talk about managers over the years. What do you want your legacy to be when they talk about Pulteney during the 2000s?
40 years from now, I'd like them to sit down, take their whiskey and go, that's awesome. That's something else. That's Pulteney. That's taking it to, you know, another level. That's, you know, something that's unique. Totally different. And if I've had a hand in that, it's not just me, it's the guys out here too. It's you know, part of a very small team. And if we've got an impact in 40 years time, that we can have a group of people sitting down and having a, you know, enjoying themselves and having a real good time, you think, well, that's what it's been all about, and that's been worth it. Something along that lines, I would say.
By way of disclosure, I visited Pulteney earlier this month as part of a press trip sponsored by Inverhouse Distillers and its parent company, International Beverages. This week's Whiskey Cast In Depth is brought to you by Glengarry. Non-chill filtered, full Highland character. Let's start off the What I'm Tasting This Week department with the whiskey Malcolm serves his father-in-law. After all, it is Father's Day weekend. The Old Pulteney 21-year-old is bottled at 46% ABV. It's a combination of Fino sherry casks and refill bourbon barrels. The nose has notes of toffee, baked apples, butterscotch, bananas, and honey, along with just a hint of smoke. The taste is mouth-puckering, tart and dry with notes of apples, lemon peel, and coconut. The finish is dry and lingering, slightly spicy with touches of baked apples with cinnamon, and a hint of coconut cream pie to boot. It's complex and excellent. I'm scoring the Old Pulteney 21-year-old a 93. Art Begg's Alligator Committee Bottling is making its way around the world and selling out quickly. It's bottled at 51.2% ABV and gets its name from the alligator charring used in many bourbon barrels. The nose, toasted oak and mesquite, vanilla, dark chocolate, and orange. The taste has a lot of toasted notes with orange, nutmeg, tangy barbecue sauce, and clove that lasts well into the finish, which explodes with a really nice pepperiness. I'm scoring the Art Begg Alligator a 92. Boonehaven is known for being mildly peated, but occasionally Andrew Brown and his team crank up the peat for a special bottling. That's the case with the Boonehaven Cruach Vona, which means peat stack in Gaelic, and is available exclusively at the World Duty Free shops in most of the UK airports. It's bottled at 50% ABV. The nose is mildly peaty with touches of brine, grass, and heather, and a muted hint of oak. The taste is peaty with tar and creosote, but balanced really well with caramel sweetness underneath, and apples, pears, and dried flowers on top, giving this dram a great mouthfeel. The finish is lingering with great peat and tar notes. Difficult to pronounce, easy to drink. I'm scoring the Boonehaven Cruach Vona a 91. You'll find all of my tasting notes in the free WhiskeyCast apps for iPhone, iPad, and Android. The Apple edition is sponsored by the Glenrothes, while the Android version is sponsored by Ben Romick. They're also available at the WhiskeyCast website, along with links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the latest WhiskeyCast HD episode from Bal Blair, and a complete archive of past episodes. The address is WhiskeyCast.com, and my email address is comments@WhiskeyCast.com. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cast Strength Media, copyright 2011, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.